Welcome to Catholic Morality and the Catechism. Monsignor William Smith talks about things our society would sometimes rather not discuss. Moral conscience, virtues, and the Ten Commandments. Here's Monsignor Smith.
Hello, I'm Monsignor Smith. I teach moral theology at St. Joseph's Seminary, Dunwoody, which is the seminary for the Archdiocese of New York. In this series, we have been examining the moral teaching of the Catholic Church, but especially the moral teaching as it is presented in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, Part 3, Life in Christ. In the first few segments, we looked at some fundamental, basic considerations that apply to all of morality. And after that, we moved into the larger part of the moral section, which is in the outline in the framework of the Ten Commandments. Here, we looked first at the typical pictorial arrangement of what they sometimes called the two tablets, namely Commandments 1, 2, and 3, which directly refer to God. And then, if you will, the second tablet, Commandments 4 to 10. And that's where we'd like to pick up on this one, considering the fourth commandment, honor your father and your mother. As the Catechism points out, this is a shift. Prior to this, it was the worship of God, God's holy name, and the Lord's Day. But here, the other half of the Ten Commandments, more than half actually, and the Catechism points out in 2021-97, remember all the reference numbers that I use will be to those numbered paragraphs in the Catechism, that this really shows the order of charity, because God has willed that after God, after Him, we should honor our parents to whom we owe life and who have handed on to us in the initial stage our very knowledge of God. We said that the commandments had been also arranged with the corresponding virtues. So the positive terms of duties to be fulfilled and virtues lived out will also be included here. Technically, St. Thomas Aquinas describes the family virtue of piety, family piety. Technically, it's part of justice. And when we say justice, justice is when you render to someone what is due to them. Commutative justice, strict justice. If you loan me $50, then I owe you $50. That's a strict contractual arrangement. Maybe some allowable interest, but that's what I owe you. Not more, not less. But St. Thomas pointed out, as did the other philosophers before him and the saints, that there are some people where we don't really talk about strict equality between equals. So that the virtue of religion, we should render to God what is due to God, but we're not the equal of God. Similarly here with the fourth commandment, you're never really equal with your parents. After all, your parents gave you life. You can't add up your tuition and your car fare and kind of write out a check and say, here, Ma, now we're even. And that's unrealistic. So it does have a connection with justice, render to people what is due to them, but it's a special kind. So they call it family justice, if you will, or family piety. True, the fourth commandment is addressed to children, as it says, honor your mother and father. Why so? Because this relationship is the most universal. Everybody is somebody's child. Although it is addressed that way, the conventional understanding of the Church is to include as well many other things under the fourth commandment. Everything that has to do with governance, everything that has to do with authority and some very intimate obligations. So the relationship of pupils to students, employees, subordinates to leaders, magistrates, even questions about church and state normally come under the title of the fourth commandment. So in 2201, it starts with the family in God's plan, the family in God's plan. Now, this is a hallmark and kind of a hallmark contribution of the teaching of John Paul II. Our Holy Father, on the prior ones on fundamentals, we referred to the encyclical Veritatis Splendor. But here, back in 1981, the Holy Father put out a most extensive apostolic exhortation called Familiaris Consortio. Familiaris Consortio. And that's about the plan of marriage and family in the modern world. and it's a gigantic and a gigantically important document, much of which is fulfilled, and at least schematically, here in the Catechism. I made the suggestion before that while reading the Catechism, we should really put a copy of the New Testament, a copy of the Bible, or at least the New Testament, right next to it. Because as we read along, we'll see that many of the footnotes, many of the citations, much of Scripture is in the text, but the footnotes have many, many citations to Holy Scripture, but also to church documentation, official documentation. And here, Familiaris Consortio. In fact, Ignatius Press, Father Fessio's press, has put out a companion volume to the Catechism, which is really just a companion of all the source doctrines, so that everything that is mentioned or cited in the Catechism, the fuller source and the fuller explanation, the context and the richness of that source is in that companion. So it's a good thing. So similarly, the Holy Father makes the statement, as they do here, the place of family in God's plan. And the Pope makes the point, which is obvious, but it has to be made more obvious, that the future of humanity passes through the family. The future of humanity passes through the family. Any society that plays fast and loose with stable marriage and family life is really a society that's rehearsing or preparing for extinction. So we have to understand, the Catechism says in 2202, that a man and a woman united in marriage, together with their children, form a family. Simple definition, obvious definition, but it's not obvious to all of our contemporaries. So we only use the term family to what it really applies. A man and a woman united in marriage, together with their children. This is a natural institution. This is God's institution. That's what we mean by family. Euphemisms about domestic partners in San Francisco or some other a spurious arrangement in Manhattan Island, that's not what we call family. What we call family is a man and a woman united in marriage, together with their children, they make a family. And that this institution, family, is prior to any recognition or invention by the state. The state's business is to support families, not to burden families. The family is anterior. The family, in fact, how do you make up society? A society is a collection of family units. They are the basic building block of every civil society. And it's a natural institution. It's not an artifice that's made up. And then they move on in 2204 on to the Christian family, which very much outlines the call in Familiaris Consortio. The Holy Father challenges couples to become what you are in Familiaris Consortio. Well, what are you? First, a community of persons. Secondly, serving life. Third, participate in the development of society. And fourth, to be a domestic church. So first, a community of persons. We don't think this way, but that's true. Remember that the Holy Trinity is first a community of persons, a community of persons. There is but one God, but three persons in God. And their life is marked by that self-giving love. And this would be the place to start with true family, and family life also should be a community of persons marked by self-giving love, a love that comes out of itself, the only love worthy of the name. Second, that they're serving life, not just the transmission of life through human procreation, but also education. Families are the first, parents are the first educators of their child. So first, become a community of persons serving life. Thirdly, participate in the development of society. And this is something we really have to pay attention to. When people make up social policies or laws or legislations or program, we should try to think first, how does this impact on stable marriage and family life? If it helps and supports and nourishes family life, I'm in favor of that program. If it undermines, complicates, burdens, or disrupts family life, I think that one you should look over a couple of times. We have to make sure that things that start out to help basket cases or correct anomalies and some other things, that we don't get ourselves into a position where our social policies begin to make family life more difficult rather than to facilitate it, help it, and nourish it. Remember, the family comes before the state. It is anterior to it. It's not an invention or dependent of the state. So first, the community of persons, second, serving life, participate in the development society, think family. And lastly, the domestic church, the family. The Second Vatican Council used this word in Latin. The Latin word for church is ecclesia, and they called the family the ecclesiola, the little church, the domestic church. Why so? Because this is really where we all become apprentices in prayer, in learning, in virtue and example. And if you've been to a baptism recently, after the blessing of the new mother and the blessing of the new father, there's a beautiful prayer that said to the parents that you, who are the first teachers of the faith, be the best teachers of their faith. That you, the parents, are the first teachers of their children and the first teachers of the faith. And the church prays with them that they be the best, by word and deed and example, that they be the best teachers of the faith. So that notion of Christian family and all the virtues that are involved there, and there are many, this is the only one of the Ten Commandments, is actually stated in a positive way. So there are probably hundreds of ways to live this out virtuously, little virtues, family virtues, probably 100 different ways in 100 different days. But we have certain anomalies here. There's an old Yiddish expression, how is it a man can raise or take care of 10 children, but 10 grown children have so much difficulty taking care of one elderly parent? That's a lack of family virtue there. That's a lack of these positive duties. So that the family comes first, and the family and society. In 2207 through 2211, the church presents a normal part of her social teaching. It sounds like a fancy term, but I think it should be clear to everybody. In 2208, it speaks about the principle of subsidiarity. Subsidiarity. What do we mean by subsidiarity? By subsidiarity, we mean that whatever the smallest group is that can take care of a problem or take care of some challenge, that's the group that should do it. It shouldn't go to a bigger group. You don't involve the federal government. You don't get the Congress to pass a law on whether you should have a stop sign or a traffic light on your neighborhood. That would be a violation of subsidiarity. You go to your local government. If it's a state issue, then finally you go up to the state. If it's a big federal case, big federal issue, then that's a national thing. So there are many things between the ultimate government, the supreme exercise of it, and the smaller unit. And it's important that families then be respected for what they can do on their own, and the government should help the parents fulfill those family responsibilities. That is respectful of subsidiarity. The only time you'd ask the government to move in is when, in an absolute basket case. If the father is so delinquent, absent, or out of it, or the parents have absolutely failed and the children are at danger of their health or their life, then some other thing should move in. But that would be a last step, a last resort, not a first resort. And it would be important that we try to popularize and correct the understanding of the principle of subsidiarity. Because it's usually on the lowest level, the level that's most involved, that know the real pluses and minuses, that know the real needs and the opportunities. And other agencies should not kind of suck them up and take them over and take their rights and privileges away, but support them so that they can do the job for which they are best equipped and of which they are most knowledgeable. So that principle of subsidiarity, it says in 2209, larger communities should take care not to usurp, not to take away family prerogatives or interfere with family life. And that's a principle that really needs more attention in our society, because some people look for the highest form of government when that's really not what is necessary at all. Look for the lowest level that can handle things properly. And of course, the most fundamental level is the family. And we should help them do what they can and what they're able to do, not take away from it and hand it to some faceless bureaucrat somewhere who's probably no more interested in the mother, father, and children, but only interested in statistics. You can't have a statistic. Now, in that positive framework of being a community of persons, serving life, participate in the development of society, and being a domestic church, the rest of the treatment of the Fourth Commandment, beginning in 22:14, starts to divide out duties within the family, duties within the understanding of the Fourth Commandment. the duties of children, to have gratitude and to be grateful for the gift of life and love and work with which their parents have provided them. And that duty of filial respect and docility. It is true that obedience toward a parent ceases upon a child's emancipation, whether they live home and take care, whether they move from home and take care of themselves, or when they are married themselves. Obedience in that sense may cease, but respect does not. In fact, there's a certain symmetry to the fourth commandment, that at the other end of life, we have duties to return some of the duties and some of the responsibilities of what our parents did for us. We in turn have the duty and responsibility to offer the same to them, but especially respect. And we should be careful about this, because I don't think in our American society, elderly folks are properly respected. Most of the people on television who come on with white hair or silver hair are usually made out to be bumbling idiots. This is offensive to a Christian standard. I think you'll find it's offensive to most Eastern people. We have many people in our diocese, both Portuguese, but especially Filipinos, who are wonderful in our nursing homes and taking care of the elderly, because they genuinely respect them, and the older folks can appreciate that. Whereas many times in our own pop culture, older people are made the object of ridicule and jokes, and there's nothing fair or respectful. In fact, it's disrespectful to do that. So obedience can change and modulate, but respect, that should never be true of respect. Similarly, they pick up then on the other part the duties of parents, both for spiritual education, support, upbringing, moral education, and the right of parents to educate their children. The Catechism says in 22:21, is primordial and inalienable. Primordial means it's from the nature of things. It is not a gift bestowed on them by our government. Their right to educate their own children is by natural right their right. And it's something that is inalienable. They can't just fritter it away or give it away. And this is important, because the education of their children comes, of course, first, not with formal education, but the education that's created in the home, education in virtue, learning things, learning virtues, learning how to pray, learning how to work, learning all the things you need to survive as adults. You know, if you're ever going to overcome narcissism, unless you want to spend the rest of your entire life in a playpen, it's when we stop throwing things and we're starting able to do things for others that gradually we learn these things naturally. In the least threatening situation, which is our own home. They are, as the new rite of baptism says, the first heralds and the first teachers of the faith. So there's an obligation to educate them in the faith. Also, an American problem is raised in 22:29, that the education of children, which is a right that belongs to parents, the parents truly have a right to choose that type of school, that type of training, that is consonant with their own values, that is consonant with their own values and their own religious convictions. Now, according to distributive justice, parents should not be forced to suffer or be discriminated against for exercising this right to choose the proper education of their children. But unfortunately, the United States is one of the few places in the developed world where we don't have it either way. And it's a bit confused. While our government says parents do have a right to choose, if they happen to choose Catholic education, Christian education, or non-public, the government says they have the right to choose that, but of course they cannot benefit from the taxes that they pay. So we have to keep working, try to work to establish a right here in distributive justice so that parents are not made to suffer and are not penalized for exercising what everybody says truly is their right. We haven't worked that out in full, but that's no reason to quit. It's something we should still work at. So children toward parents, parents towards children. The other segment of the fourth commandment has to do with authority in civil society. And there are things here that have to do with our duties as a citizen. As a citizen, we have an obligation, according to the fourth commandment, to participate, to share both the burdens and the benefits of our society, and that citizens have duties, and some of them get quite specific here. And some of them are things on which some Catholics are not really well informed. 2240 says, for instance, that both submission to authority and co-responsibility makes it morally obligatory, in 2240, to pay our just taxes. That's not an option. That's an obligation, to pay our just taxes, to pay our fair share in society. Speaking about the right to vote, sometimes it's so important that it becomes really a matter of seriousness to exercise that right and to defend our country when that is necessary. The Catechism also brings up some specifics about nations that are better off, perhaps like our own, should be generous in the opportunities that we offer to foreigners in search of security and even a means of livelihood. But the Catechism is also realistic in 2241 when it says about immigrants, they too are obliged to have respect and gratitude for the heritage of the country that receives them and to obey its laws and to assist in carrying out their civic burdens. So sometimes people make up their own ideas about sanctuary and amnesty and things like that. Well, let us be respectful of those potential immigrants who go to an American embassy, who fill out the forms as we ask them to, and we shouldn't penalize those people who go by our rules and end up rewarding people who don't go by our rules, and the Catechism is clear on that. It's also clear that there's a moral obligation to refuse obedience to civil authority when that civil authority oversteps its bounds, when it goes against natural law or divine positive law. We do render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, but we render to God the things that are God. And the Catechism quotes rather generously and properly from the teaching of the Second Vatican Council, especially Gaudium et Spes here. And in 2243, it even states that at times resistance, even armed resistance, can be legitimate, but it puts it under very stringent conditions, which, according to Catholic tradition, have to fulfill certain criteria. We have to be talking about not one or two characters who are just annoyed or hotheads, but when certain grave, prolonged violation of basic rights are involved, when all peaceful means have been exhausted, when there is a well-founded hope of success, and when such judgments are truly representative, then and only then is it legitimate to resist in that question. 2244 talks about the political community in the church, and probably in American terms we'd say this is the church and state issue, the church and state issue. And that should be understood correctly, because in 2245 it says very clearly, the church is not to be confused with the political community. And the church should respect and encourage political freedom and the responsibility of all her citizens. That's the teaching of Vatican II. However, it is the part of the church's mission, it says in 2246, to pass moral judgments, even in matters related to politics, whenever the fundamental rights of man and the salvation of souls require it. Now that's out of Gaudium et Spes, 76, out of the Second Vatican Council. It's repeated here in the Catechism, and it's one that we should be better informed about. Some people get a little bit sloppy in this regard. Notice the qualifications. Whenever the fundamental rights, even in the political area, now, the state should be respected as a political institution, the church should be separate as a church institution. We don't want advice from the state about how to administer the seven sacraments, and there are certain civil matters. But sometimes there's an overlap, and where the rights of the human person or the salvation of souls is required, for instance, if you change a law that all of a sudden allows the innocent unborn to be killed, no one can tell me, well, that's just politics and the church should stay out of politics. That's not politics. There's politics involved in it, but this is a violation of the Fifth Commandment. This is a violation of God's law. The purpose of law is to protect the innocent. And when that law is so twisted that it justifies what actually it should protect, that is an unjust law. Unjust laws do not bind in conscience. So we make distinctions. We don't cause riots or make scenes where that's not appropriate. But this balance, we do believe in the separation of the institutions of the church and the state. The institutions. We do not believe in the separation of religion from life. religion from life. But even where there is overlap, and when there is, and it's something very serious, like fundamental human rights are being overrun, or the salvation of souls really requires it, then the authorities in the church have not only the option, then they have a duty. They have a duty to speak up and speak correctly. In fact, I think the Holy Father, John Paul II, gives the best example in his own personal teaching. Priests and bishops and clergy should preach and teach the truths about God and the truths about man, and also the true social teaching and principles of the church, not partisan proposals. Nobody should use a pulpit for partisan proposals, but you can always use a pulpit to talk about the Ten Commandments. It's really a partisan proposal, and you've taught the truth about man, the truth about God, and you've taught real principles, then that is really in the hands of lay people to form their consciences properly and to make a difference in the public forum. We don't want to do anything partisan, but we also want to make sure that we truly do render to God the things that are God. Yeah, and then you can give to Caesar whatever, but only what is due to Caesar.
Join us again next time for Catholic Morality and the Catechism on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.